Today's Teisho will be on case 43, Bodhidharma didn't come to China. Zhuifeng Yishun called Xuanhua Shibei of Fuzhou a true ascetic, and whenever he saw him, said, "You're a reborn sage. Why don't you go on pilgrimage to study Zen?" In response, Xuanzha said, "Bodhidharma didn't come to China. The second patriarch didn't go to India." Zhuifeng accepted this answer. So some of you, probably there's nobody in the room who doesn't know the story of Dhammo of Daruma Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma is the Indian monk who is supposed to have brought Zen from his homeland to China. And if you go to any Zen temple in East Asia, you're likely to see a picture of Bodhidharma. And sometimes he looks very fierce and has a beard and often an earring. He's bald. He has a beard and an earring is hanging out of his earlobe. Some people have debated the historicity, as scholars say, of Bodhidharma. Was there really such a person? Did he really come to China they say he did, and so on? And some people have said, no, there's no such person. Some people say there was a person named Bodhidharma. Some people say there was a person named Bodhiruchi who might, there were apparently a number of monks coming to China at this time, bringing what later became Zen. So it's all a big muddle as far as historical studies go. But there's still a lot of evidence that Bodhidharma really existed. And there's a lot of evidence that he is the one who brought, or one of the people who brought, the Zen school to China. A little earlier in the session, we were looking at a moment earlier in Bodhidharma's history, and I think last week at the Teisho, time we had Teisho at the university, I might have been discussing how Bodhidharma met Emperor Wu of Liang, right, in the famous interview with Wu of Liang, and that didn't go very well, and Bodhidharma went into the land of Wei. I believe you've probably heard all of this before. At any rate, when people in the Zen world talk about Buddhism or Zen coming to America, they ask the question, has Bodhidharma come to the West? And in China, it was common to say that Bodhidharma had come from the West, right? So Bodhidharma is like this symbol of Zen. And he's like the founder of the Zen tradition. And so this koan is, is an interesting koan, right? This Zen student says to this master, "You are really a great ascetic. You are really a great cultivator. You're a reborn sage. You're like in your, you're an enlightened person who has returned to this world. Why don't you go on a pilgrimage to study Zen. And in response, Xuanzha said, Bodhidharma didn't come to China, and the second ancestor didn't go to India. He's supposed to have gone to India. So the koan is Bodhidharma didn't go to China, which, you know, all the paintings, sometimes there are these paintings that show him crossing the ocean on a reed miraculously and landing and so on. So this is like completely, completely counterfactual. Okay, so basically, we live in a world where, as I mentioned earlier in the session, you know, the human mind creates an image of reality which seems all-encompassing and satisfactory, you know, and so, you know, just the way the mind works is that we create a coherent picture, right? And we never or rarely experience moments where our reality is, we suddenly say, something happened to me this afternoon, and rarely do people say, it just makes no sense at all. They might say that, but they don't really mean it. They mean it's a minor variation from ordinary reality. So, you know, basically, your daughter who was going to medical school calls you on the phone and says she's going to New York to be a Broadway actress. And you might say, what's happened today just makes no sense at all. But we really don't have moments where we say something happened, or we rarely have moments where we say, this afternoon something happened to me for which I have no words. I literally can't describe it. You know, that's relatively rare in human experience, right? Usually when we say that, we have words right up our sleeve and we use them, see? So we create this picture of the world which is very coherent, and then there's the whole element of social reinforcement, right? So if you think about something like people's gender and sexual expression, right? You know, basically, in our culture, it's thought to be the case that, or has been thought to be the case for a long time, that you're either a male or you're either a boy or a girl, right? And at birth, you know, it used to be the case, I don't know if it is anymore, when a boy was born, people would, if they had a baby shower, all the items for the baby had were blue, like blue ribbon. Blue is the color for boys. And then if it was a girl, all the items would be pink, because pink is the color for girls, right? So from the minute you emerge, you know, basically into the world, you were getting either a pink rattle or a blue rattle, right? And this goes, you know, this, you might know the movie To Kill a Mockingbird, right? And Scout is a deviant because she doesn't want to wear a dress. She wants to wear coveralls like her brother, right? And this marks her as an odd kid in town, right? So basically, you know, you're either a male or you're a female. You're either a boy or a girl. You're either a man or a woman. And you know, what has happened in our time is that people have said, you know, I don't really feel like a woman, or I don't really feel like a man. And you know, that creates a lot of cognitive dissonance. You know, people feel unhappy because they're playing this role that's not satisfying to them. And lately people have been saying, you know, maybe it's not as simple as you're a man or you're a woman. You know, maybe, you know, basically there's not like, you know, those are possibilities, but there's like a, you know, the spectrum, right? There's like a spectrum, and at one end is like this super feminine identity, and at the other is this super masculine identity, right? Like Bruce Willis or something. And you know, people can be all along that continuum, or, you know, basically a person who was born basically with what people might say is a feminine a biology could be at the Bruce Willis end of the spectrum, and so on. So, you know, in this little way, we see how, you know, we create a reality that we call real and think of as real. And, you know, even today, it's incredibly hard for people of a certain generation to, like, wrap their minds around the idea that, you know, a person's biology doesn't mean that equates to their sexuality or their gender identity. And it's created like a firestorm, right? The idea that people who basically have one set of genitalia might want to share bathroom with somebody who has another set of genitalia is like almost like going to plunge us into a civil war. And there's a lot of people who feel that this is all like a fad. It's like a fad. And basically, I can't wait for this all to be over so we can get back to reality, right? And there's lots of other cases like this in our society of people having these ideas about what is real, and you know the universe is really more complex than that. So basically. You know, we have our own mental system for sort of like screening out inconsistencies and challenges to our reality. We all have this mental apparatus that sort of allows us to keep going in a way that is reasonably coherent, and we don't feel overwhelmed by the unexpected, right? So we have a mental apparatus, but we also have like this culture that's pressuring us to accept what everybody else believes, right? And this takes so many different forms. Culture also does this. So for example, you know, not next year, but the year after, I'm scheduled to teach a course called Once Upon a Time, and it's an introductory course to literature, and it's all about how the structure of stories, you know. And you know, if you think about it, stories have a beginning and a middle and an end. Everybody knows this because it's common sense. So you know, basically you start with some kind of an event and some kind of a normal situation, and then there's some kind of a challenge to that, right? You're a hobbit, you're having a nice life, and then you get this ring of power, right? And you know, this whole thing happens, right? And at the end, order has been restored, right? And the ring has been destroyed, and the hobbits can go back to the Shire, right? And Gandalf can come with his pipe, you know, and so on. So that's like a classic story. But of course, the world does not actually have story structures like that. That is not true, right? I mean, things happen and they just keep happening. And there is, I think it's fair to say, there's no such thing as an ending. There's no such thing as a beginning, right? So you can say, well, you know, I was born on such a day, but you know, actually, you really weren't born on that day. You know, you came into existence at some other point, you know, 9 months earlier, right? But you know, even then, you know, I mean, if you think about something like, you know, sperms and eggs, you know, basically, you know. It's hard really to say where your parents existence ends and yours begins, you know, biologically, right? And so there, you know, it's hard to really, it isn't the case that things have an ending and a beginning and a middle, that really it's more like one damn thing after another over and over again, right? And actually, we also assume that there's one storyline, right? And you know, if you have a parallel storyline or another possible storyline, we think, well, one of them has to be the real thing and the other is the false thing. But you know, in reality, there probably isn't such a such a thing, right? There that you know, people actually talk about like things have multiple causes, and there's multiple chains of causation that make things happen, you know. Different explanations can be all correct because it just depends on how you're approaching things, right? At any rate, we have all of these safeguards, right, that guarantee we are within the normative reality. And there's no reason to believe that that is really reality. And one of the things that happens, like, I'm not a scientist, you know, my knowledge of science is very limited, but I'm impressed by how often, like, scientists are saying things about the world. They say things that just don't make any sense, right? So, you know, the idea that there's no such thing as matter flies in the face of all of our evidence, right? It's like, you know, if you crash your car into a tree, you die. You know, what killed you, right? And if you say, well, actually, it's really energy systems, right, colliding or something like that, that makes some sense. But the point is, you know, a lot of science generates images of the world that don't confirm lots of our basic assumptions, right? We trust in the consensus reality. We trust in our ordinary, like, reality machine to deliver a reality to us that's reliable and trustworthy and so on. And when we're in doubt, you know, we try to close up the inconsistencies because that's how we stay sane, right? And when we're in doubt, we turn to others, right? So we might say, you know, my friend Susan did this the other day. I don't know what to make of that, you know. And then you might be thinking something, and then you might go to somebody else and say, what do you heard about what happened to Susan? What do you think? And the person will basically sort of like heal up the injured reality, right? So now it's like, ah, okay, reality, we're back. And this system's very compelling and very powerful because, you know, people who do get out of line can be punished or ridiculed and you know, all kinds of creative people get punished for stepping out of line. We see that. So you know, what does this have to do with Buddhism? You know, basically, the Buddhist view is that our world picture is profoundly mistaken. Okay, so our world picture is profoundly mistaken, right? And people who get into Buddhism sort of find that an intriguing idea. But if you go the whole distance, right, you know, I'm just telling you the truth, you're going to live in a very different world a lot of the time. And you say, well, how different? And all I can say is, please go the distance, you know. It's so different that if I told you, you wouldn't believe me, right? So, you know, the Zen pedagogy, if you want to call it that, is to just take it one step at a time, right? So basically, if you say to lots of people, there is really no such thing as an enduring self. You know, some people will just think that's the most preposterous thing you could possibly. It's like, what? Well, who the hell is eating this lunch? You know, who? You know, or who? What? Who the hell is Kurt then? Right? You know, I don't get confused about Kurt. I know I'm Kurt. You know, and so you know, this seems like the most rock solid. You know, our famous French, you know, Monsieur Descartes said, you know, I think, therefore I am. What could be more obvious, right? You know, so Zen, you know, Buddhism says, actually teaches anatta, the teaching of no self. And, you know, when Buddhists try to present that in a public Western context, you get a lot of pushback and counter arguments and so on. And, you know, the Zen pedagogy is that, the Zen approach is, there's no sense, you can tell people that. You can say there's no self and they can agree or disagree, right? But actually, it doesn't make a difference unless it changes their experience. So Zen is really not about like getting into hair splitting debates with people, right? Because it's pointless. Right. Even if you agree, it might not change anything. You might say, I have disposed of the idea of self, right? But you're still living the self, right? So what Zen does is to say, let's just explore the breath, right? You know, and you start. So Zen doesn't tell you what you're going to find, but it says it sets up like a little. It's like a lab experiment. They say, just try this, you know, put this chemical in the beaker with this and let's just see what happens, right? So you sit down on the cushion and you go into samadhi and you know, one of the things that might happen to you, and you might walk past it, but one of the things that might happen to you is that you go into deep samadhi and you begin to have these thoughtless intervals. And you might not say, oh, I'm having thoughtless intervals, right? But there are these moments, and somebody might, you know, the teacher or you might be suddenly notice, you know, I'm not really thinking at all. What are you thinking about? You know, actually, I'm having no thoughts. So you know, you may or may not notice that right away, but eventually you notice you have these moments where there's just absolutely no thinking activity in your mind. You're registering the sensations without this screen of naming and you know, a discursive chatter. And you could have argued with somebody all day, but that's a real breakthrough, right? Because, you know, most people, I work in English department, most people will tell you there is no experience outside. They will tell you. If you talk to English professors, they'll say, no, there is no experience outside of language. Language, everything starts with, and it's like, no, it doesn't. It doesn't, I swear. And if they, you know, if you could get them in, if you could get them to sit on the cushion for a while, they would suddenly realize that it would take them a while because they'd be resistant to the idea. But eventually, you know, they'd start to realize that's the damnedest thing, right? I'm having moments where I'm experiencing, but I'm not thinking. See, and that's the beauty, I think, of Zen, right? Is that we really do it. We don't talk about it, we really do it. And talking about it doesn't do much good, right? It really has, we're really like exploring reality, and when you come out on the other side, you know it's true because you've experienced it. So we could have I could have a debate with my learned friends about whether everything is linguistically mediated or not. But actually in Zen we know that it's not, you know, because we have these long periods where we're not experiencing with thought, and then. You know, we also have these experiences that are very hard to put into words, right? And it's like, how is that possible? Okay. And also, you know, when you're watching your breath and you begin to have these thoughtless intervals, right, you also, and it may take a long time for people to realize this, but, you know, it may take a couple years of practice, you suddenly realize, you know, you're going for long periods of time without referencing yourself. And, you know, it may take a while before people realize, you know, if I, Kurt, am the thinker, how come I, Kurt, am not present when thinking is going on? And you might also say, I'm actually not always thinking. So sometimes I'm thinking, but I'm not Kurt thinking. It just feels like the thoughts are rolling along and I don't know where they're coming from or where they're going. See, that's a very interesting, it's like thoughts are coming and thoughts are going, and some of the thoughts are thoughts of Kurt. But a lot of the thoughts are just thoughts, and Kurt is nowhere to be found. And then you may have these moments where you're so deeply in a thoughtless state, you know, that when you come out of it, you don't know where you are. And you don't go, who am I? But for a long, for an interval afterwards, there's like no, there's no self-referencing, right? And it feels wonderful. It's like, oh my God, I wonder why I feel so happy, right? So you know, this is just, this is the product, this sort of revolutionary change in how we see the world is the product of just a little bit, you know, several years probably of practice, of determined practice. And you already have like overturned a lot of the basic structure of Western civilization, right? Without even trying, you know, just some city. But it points to how very different reality is from what our even our own ordinary experience growing up, and also our cultural messaging and our, you know, group dynamics that keep us locked in place. So, you know, it takes, even if you are having on the cushion experiences of selflessness, you for a long time you might believe that there is an essential self all the same, because you've always grown up believing that. But, you know, one day you're just sitting in that selfless state and somebody says, you know, there's no self, and you go, oh, of course, you know, and I'm, of course there's none. And, you know, if Kurt is not the source of his own thoughts, what is the source of his own thoughts, right? Where are these thoughts coming from if they're not coming from Kurt, right? And, you know, if you, you know, Zen is all about going back to the most, the only way we can escape from all of this is to go back to our most immediate experience. And when you go back to your most immediate experience, right, you realize thoughts enter my awareness, or they come into awareness, and they stay in awareness for a while, and then they disappear. Where they come from, I do not know, and where they go is far from clear. You know, in fact, in Chinese Buddhism, there's a kind of meditation practice called Wato, watching the head of the thought. And that's where you're always looking at the source of the thought, basically, which is unknowable. It's like our thoughts arise in our attention out of like this darkness, and they stay for a while and then they go back into darkness. That's really our most immediate experience of thinking. Thoughts arise mysteriously and then they go away mysteriously. It's like a stream of consciousness, but the source and the destination are not obvious to us. So all of this is like profoundly transforming our picture of the world, maybe more than you've stopped to think about, and it's not really that important to think about it. But the thing is, you know, Zen is take Buddhism, and Zen is so is like a very experience-directed Buddhism. is taking you out of the world that you were told is real, and it's taking you to a world that other people might not understand, right? So if you said to somebody, well, I'm only intermittently Kurt, and I don't know, he arises and goes away, I don't know where, right? People might think you need some, like, psychiatric help, right? But actually, you would be super sane, right? You would be super sane. And it's not delusion to say self is only present intermittently, and it arises and goes away, and I am not aware of the source of it or where it goes, you know. That would be a statement of, you know, really like empirical fact, as a matter of fact. So this process of, if I had a group of people who came and they wanted to hear about Buddhism, you know, I would tell them stories about, you know, like great enlightenment figures. I'd say, you know, and then one day he was gathering water and the bucket fell out, the bucket came out of the bottom of his, his water bucket, the bottom dropped out and he had a daikensho. Great. You know, so I would tell a story, because stories are a conventional way of understanding reality, even though nothing really exists as a story. And I would tell, you know, there'd be a beginning, a middle, and end, there'd be a hero, you know, etc. But, you know, basically the Buddhist view is that all of this is quite false, and it's the source of our suffering, right? So if you think about something like, how many times as a teenager were you unhappy with your physical appearance? Maybe you weren't, you know, but many people are when they're young. You know, I read all the time about all these people who, like, are doctoring their selfies. You know, they put pictures on, but they also Photoshop them, so they look better, their cheeks are a little wider, you know, that kind of thing. So basically, you know, think of all the times you felt worthless or unloved. And, you know, you've been worried about this, basically you've misunderstood yourself. And so much of your suffering has been caused by not understanding that you're not the source of your own life. You know, and it's such a consolation sometime when we realize, you know, we're in abject misery and suddenly we realize that, you know, Kurt is like a motel room that I'm staying in for a little while, for like literally like that. And then I'm moving on, you know. It's like, why am I so worried about Kurt? And, you know, it's easy to say, it's hard to have that insight. It takes a lot of sitting, but when you have it, it's you're unbound. It's like your chains have been cut off. You know, so a lot of our ordinary thinking causes us suffering, and Buddhism is really saying much of our understanding of the world is false, right? And as you go on in your practice, more and more of your experience is going to be difficult to describe using ordinary language, and it's going to be at variance with what you know to be true. So look, there are lots of cults in the world where people will tell you we're really reincarnated Venusians, right? There was that cult, a while back, many of you, when I say a while back, some of the younger people here will not have been born yet, but there was this cult where they all the guys castrated themselves and took, male hormones. And they believed that that was a more evolved state. And they believed they were reincarnated beings from another planet who could come to usher the planet Earth into a new age. And that is truly false, you know. But you know, Buddhism is based on like your most immediate experience, right? Your most immediate concrete experience, what's actually happening to you. And that's so it's not based on any teachings, although their library is full of Buddhist teachings. It's based on your immediate experience, and for a long time, some of what happens to you will not make much sense. So you may come into the Dokusan room and say something, and I'll be delighted. Or you may come into the Dokusan room and you say, I've got it, I've got the answer. The answer is, it's all one. And I'll say, yeah, that's really not it, you know, but good, you know, you're doing a good job. I'll say, really, that's really not it, you know. And it had the feeling of being true, but I just said, you know, no. On the other hand, you may come into the Dokusan room and say, you know, something, and I'll go, oh my gosh, that's wonderful. And you may think, what? What? What part of what I just said was wonderful? you might even come in and say, oh man, my legs are killing me. And it, you know, that could be the best answer to a certain koan. And I would go, oh, that's great. And you might leave thinking, well, I'm glad he likes it, or who knows. But, you know, basically, the koans are like taking some aspect of experience, of our reality, our real reality, and we're trying to do an end run around our cultural assumptions and our personal mistaken views by taking you right back to experience. And you know, you may come into the Dokusan room and you kind of have the answer, but you don't know why. It's like you're walking past it, right? It's like sometimes people won't even present it as an answer. They'll say, oh, nothing's coming up. And I'll say, well, tell me about what's happening on the cushion. And they'll go, oh, I don't know. You know, well, people might be working on the Mu Koan. And they'll say, I had a good sit. You know, my mind was really blank. And then I keep thinking about my brother, and I can't put him out of my mind. You know, my sashin is going down the tubes. And you know, basically, you know, when our minds are blank, you know, some of the things that are important but under the surface begin to bubble up. See, and so you know, at that point, I might say, well, what are you feeling about your brother? You know, and the person might say, I'm not sure. And if I press, maybe the brother, there's a lot of conflict or unhappiness, or it's the brother did the person an injury. And the person who's working on Mu might think all of this is irrelevant and a distraction. But actually, this is part of the process. It's like we're bringing into the light of day all of these mental habits, basically, that get in the way of being awake. And sometimes people will give me answers, and I'll say, that's wonderful, and they'll go out of their room like scratching their heads. Right. So you know, for a long time in Zen practice, you're going through this process of doing an end run around your culture and having an experience that may be hard to put in words, and then presenting it to the teacher. And you know, but it's you know, the Buddha himself used this metaphor of the blind man and the elephant. That everybody knows that story, but people don't know that comes from ancient India. And the Buddha said, if you don't know the story, he said, you know, basically, when I teach, it's like the blind man and the elephant, right? So basically, a blind man wants to encounter the elephant, and he feels the leg of the elephant and says, oh, an elephant is like a tree trunk. And another person feels the ear of the elephant and says, oh, the elephant is like a great plant. This is like a giant leaf. And somebody else grabs the elephant's tail, right? And basically says, oh, the elephant's like a snake, you know. And they're all right, but how does it all fit together? And, you know, Zen practice is like one koan is the elephant's tail, and one koan is the elephant's leg, and one koan is the elephant's ear, and so on. And, you know, at some point, the whole elephant is standing in front of you, right? It's like you see, you get the whole elephant, right? And our word for that is daikensho. It's like seeing the elephant, right? And, you know, until then, it's just like pieces of the elephant, you know? But it's not going back to ground zero. You're not going back to the beginning each time, right? It's like every time you have a little insight or a little opening into reality, you're groping around and suddenly you realize, oh, it's like a snake, or oh, it's like a tree, right? Every time you do that, you know, your reality, your experience of reality, real reality, is becoming a little bigger, right? Even after people see the whole elephant, then it's kind of a challenge. How do I integrate this into my daily life, right? So it's like if physicists, you know, they live in conceptually a very different world from the one they live in. And, you know, they can be a regular dad and they can also know, you know, that matter doesn't exist, right? And that kind of thing. It's a little more complicated with Buddhism because we want to integrate completely, right? And part of the reason we want to integrate is because the world picture of ordinary reality causes so much unhappiness. And also we're motivated because, you know, culture can change, people can grow, the world could be a much better place. It could be a hugely better place if people weren't so selfish or fearful and so on. So you know, Zen is all about not accepting the obvious, right, or the truth, the so-called truth. And an argument doesn't do it. It's all experience-based. And, you know, when you go into Mushin, emptiness is so important in Zen. It's so important because it's the moment where you can get out of all these habits for a little bit and you can see things in a new light. It's not guaranteed, right? It's not guaranteed, but there's a bigger probability, right? That if you just keep going into emptiness, you know, you're going to notice something that you didn't notice before. You're going to come in and say, nothing's happening on the cushion, you know, and I'll say, well, what, tell me what is happening if you're not answering your call. And they'll say, I don't know, my mind goes blank. And it's like, oh, thank God, you know, your mind is, you've discovered it, you know. It's one little step at a time, but, you know, eventually there's going to be this, the elephant will appear to you, right? And then you have to lead the elephant back into the, you know, mistaken, confused, super destructive world, right? That's the process, that's the practice. Okay. Zhuifeng Yisun called Xuanxia Shibei of Fuzhou, a true ascetic. And whenever he saw him, he said, you're a reborn sage. Why don't you go on a pilgrimage to study Zen? In response, Shansha is deeply awake. He said, Bodhidharma didn't come to China. The second patriarch didn't go to India. Zhuifeng accepted this answer. So Xuanxia says, look, going on a pilgrimage, you know, that's nice, it's okay, please feel free, you know, great. But you know, you're still in conventional reality, right? You're really just, you know, that's nice. And you know, generally speaking, devotion is nice, but this is about liberating ourselves from illusion. And that begins with rejecting the obvious, right? That means rejecting what we know to be true. There is a self, of course there's a self. We're all separate, right? Each of us is an individual. And then one day on the cushion, you suddenly realize that you feel absolutely as though everyone around you is part of yourself. You feel it absolutely, everybody is your body. Like in the Diamond Sutra says, one body. It's one body, the universe is one body. And you think, oh, what a pretty idea, or what bullshit, right? And then one day you're sitting on the cushion and it's impossible to say where you start and where the other person stops, right? And you just feel completely, you feel that the person's breath next to you is your breath. And you can say, well, that the Zen view is that is more real than what we normally assume. We normally assume it's everybody's separate, blah, blah, blah. But that's a distorted consciousness. That's a distorted view. The Zen view is that when we connect, we feel that deep sense of connection. We have to work really hard because we're so trapped in our illusions. But when we get a glimpse of that, we're seeing the truth. That's the Buddhist view. So please, you know, I have to say, people are sitting so well. It's amazing. It's like a dream come true. You know, people are coming into Dokusan with the most wonderful responses. People are, you know, and if you're struggling with your koan, that's also a wonderful response, you know. Being lost is the most important thing. So, you know, when the teacher says, I don't think that's it. You know, that's not a defeat. You know, that's the practice, is being lost. It's a clear-eyed person falling into a well. That's the essence of Zen practice. You know, that's the essence. So everybody's doing a wonderful job.